and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, a talk on Canada's Arctic foreign policy given by the Consul of Canada in Anchorage, Jennifer Lowen. Recorded on Friday, January 28th at the Alaska World Affairs Council, listen to Jennifer Lowen speak on Canada's Arctic foreign policy next on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans after the news.
Welcome, everyone. Hello. Hi, I'm Lisa Falsko. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and welcome, everyone.
Now I'd like to introduce our head table. At my far left, we have Ms. Anne Lovejoy, who is a member of our Board of Directors and gives us a lot of great ideas. We are so thankful to have her with us. And to her right is Keith Steinbaugh, the president of our board of directors, who makes my job very great every day. And I'd like to introduce him to the podium to introduce our speaker.
Thanks, Lisa. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Consul Jennifer Lowen. Ms. Lowen is a career diplomat. She joined Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade, or DFAIT, in 1997. She has served at DFAIT's Ottawa headquarters and also overseas, notably as Canada's coordinator for the Fourth Summit of the Americas, as Canadian representative to the Kimberley process for rough diamond certification, and she's also contributed to government support for sound practices in Canadian international mining operations. She comes to Anchorage from her most recent assignment, where she was the deputy director for Canada-U.S. relations at DFAIT headquarters. Before joining the government of Canada, Ms. Lowen worked as a country director in Ghana, West Africa, for a prominent Canadian non-governmental organization, and at Canada's International Development Research Center, which is an independent think tank dedicated to global sustainability. She holds a Master of Philosophy from the University of Cambridge in the UK. She lives here in Anchorage with her husband and their four sons. She's here today to speak to us on Canadian perspectives on a changing Arctic. And one quick note before we welcome her to the podium, she does have to leave at 1 p.m. sharp for another engagement, so we may be a little limited on questions at the end, but please join me in welcoming Jennifer Lowen to our podium today.
All right, well, sorry that I have to fly out of here, but I'll compensate by speaking ridiculously quickly, which is a tendency of mine anyway. So anyway, thanks, Keith, for that great introduction. And I'd also like to thank the World Affairs Council for having me here today. It's always great fun to come and speak in front of a room full of people about something that I feel very passionately about and which matters very deeply to Canadians. No, it's not hockey. Today we're going to talk about the Arctic. It's absolutely, and having made the crack about hockey, it's just something that Canadians do. It's part of our identity. But so is the Arctic, and that's why that matters so much to us. And I think that's why our government has worked very hard to get out in front of what the world now needs to do in a part of the world that's quickly taking on unexpected prominence. And yet, it's always been there. It's been with us in our psyches, in the culture of Canada. It's been there as part of who we are and where we're going. And not only is it part of our past, it's a vital piece of our future. And that's why we need to, I think, seize this opportunity to look hard at what's going on in the Arctic and why it will be important. Canada has taken steps in that direction, and we've crafted a specific national policy called the Northern Strategy Agenda, which has domestic and international implications. It's got a clear vision for the North, and based on that vision, Canada has implemented a number of initiatives that I'm going to walk you through today. And because of that strategy, because we have a policy framework, the North and its future and how it is part of Canada's identity is integrated in national policies that relate to economic development and indeed our National Economic Action Plan. So, moving right along, push the right button. The North, again, as I mentioned, it's a fundamental part of Canada. It's part of our heritage, part of our future, and our identity as a country. Our whole approach to the Northern Strategy is actually about strengthening stewardship in the Arctic region. There are a number of elements that are affecting the Arctic that we're all very aware of. First of all, climate change, and I'll talk about that a little bit more down the road, balancing with the environment, and most importantly, it's about the lives of Northerners. And it's certainly the understanding of the Government of Canada that the Arctic is a nuanced and challenged environment, and you need to take careful attention to understand it well and to understand the people who live there in order to have an effective approach. First and foremost, and I think a priority for the strategy itself, is that the Arctic is about people. It's about the people who live there. It's about the Inuit who've lived there for thousands of years, who've made the North their home, and who were there and remain in place as Canada has developed further south. The clear vision of the Government of Canada is one in which we protect our territory through an enhanced presence on the land. We foresee the North as a place where there are healthy and vital communities and where Northerners manage their own affairs, both in the sea and over the sky. We also feel that we need to embed our strategy in the traditional respect for land and the environment that has always been part of the Northern way of life. Principles of sustainability, based on sound science combined with traditional knowledge, is going to be an important part of the policymaking that the Government of Canada will pursue. We also believe that strong, accountable and reliable and responsible governments in the North are going to be part of the prosperous future for Northerners. So the Northern strategy, building on what I had just said, these are the four pillars that are at its heart. First of all, sovereignty. Canada will exercise its sovereignty in the North, and we will work through sound science and reliable partnerships internationally to ensure recognition for the full extent of Canada's territory in the North. We also feel that economic and social development have to be a key part of any strategy for the North. It's got to be about building a reliable, carefully regulated, and well-managed economy that benefits Northerners and benefits their lives. Environmental protection has to be a part of Northern strategy as well. We're living in a time when the North is changing rapidly, when climate change is affecting everybody's lives. And again, sound science and careful policy will be part of an ecosystems-based management approach to the Arctic. And finally, I mentioned this before, governance. Devolution of governance. The North has been run from Ottawa for a long time, and that can no longer be the case. Going forward, the Government of Canada is committed to ensuring that the lives of Northerners are based on decisions that they make themselves and things that make sense to Northerners in the North, and that increasingly, decision-making, skills and abilities to do that and to control their own destiny are part of the way the North is run. Beyond that, and part of our commitment internationally, Canada will remain committed to ensuring that Northerners continue to take part in international fora where decisions about the Arctic are being made. They're permanent participants, which is something that's unique about the Arctic Council, and I'll talk about that more later. But in addition, they will always be part of Canadian delegations. They always have been, and they will always be part of the decision-making process in Canada. I just want to quickly point to two things. The Northern Strategy Agenda is primarily a domestic policy agenda, but it has international components. And all four of the pillars, as you can see in our cute little schema, have domestic and international dimensions and are expressed both domestically and internationally. And in addition, science and technology underpin the strategy at every step of the way. We don't know enough about the Arctic. We don't know enough about the things that affect the developments in the North, and we need to make sure that policy decisions are grounded solidly in science. So, the Canadian North. That's one way to look at it, and we'll look at it a few other ways going forward. It's a gigantic piece of territory. It's 40% of Canada's landmass, which in and of itself is staggering. For me, I guess it all sort of came home personally when I was lucky enough to be able to take a trip up to Alert, which is number one. And it's a place where you do indeed want to be alert. it took me, I flew to Calgary from here, which I thought was a long trip because I had to go way south and then up to Calgary. Then I went from Calgary 9 hours north to get to Cambridge Bay. And then another 9 hours further as we began to approach Alert. And we landed in an environmental weather station. And the name of it eludes me now, but we spent the night there because of weather, and then we continued another 4 or 5 hours north before we got to Alert. We spent about 12 hours on the ground, turned around, came back again, which is another story, but it's a long way up there, and as you fly over the territory, you can't but feel impressed at not only the tremendous size, but the remarkable potential of the Arctic. Now, Now, here's what the Northern Strategy Agenda is really all about. It's about the people of the North. It's about their lives, their futures. It's about their traditions and their beliefs. The people who live in the North are the Inuit, which means people in Inuktitut, and they've occupied that territory for millennia. There are about 50,000 Inuit in Canada today. And again, their lives and traditions are deeply rooted in this vast Arctic land. Most of the Inuit inhabit a part of Canada called Nunavut, which was the result of a land claim settlement that was completed in 1999. The population of the North and of the Inuit is interesting because it's a fairly young population. 35% of the Inuit are under 15 years of age. That's compared to 18% in the rest of the Canadian population at large, and has important implications. The other thing that's worth knowing is that a large percentage of the Inuit population subsist on harvested country food, and most of them exchange and gather this food in traditional ways. And most of them share and give away country food to other people in their households. So it's a very integrated community. But I want to underline, having said what I said about the youth and this population, 51% of Inuit adults do not have a high school education, which I think is another important thing that we need to be aware of going forward in working with the North. Just south of the Arctic Circle, there are other kinds of Aboriginal Indigenous people that occupy what's considered the North, but not necessarily the High Arctic. Among these are the Dene, the Gwich'in, the Cree, and the Métis. They make up 25% and 51% of the populations of the Yukon and the Northwest Territories in Canada, respectively. So there are considerable chunks of the population in those two provinces. Indigenous people are called Aboriginals in Canada, and they're collectively made up of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. So when you hear that term used, it's collectively referring to all Indigenous peoples in Canada. The population in the Arctic not only includes Indigenous people, it also, and I mentioned it was 25% and 51% respectively, the other chunks of populations are made up of North American Europeans, the people that you see around you in this room right now, as well as about 4% of visible minorities in Canada. So it's a population that's diverse, and increasingly so. So that's the sort of human, I guess, quilt that's the backdrop to what's going on in the Arctic in Canada right now. But this is another important piece of the puzzle, is what we're all aware of about the changing conditions of the Arctic and climate change. This slide shows minimum ice in 2007, and there's a ton of science going on. I'm not a scientist. I'm not going to wade into that debate. But I will say that what happens in the North and what happens to the ice cover is going to affect the way people can live their lives and the kinds of things that will affect them, which we're about to get into. This slide doesn't show ice thickness, and it's important to know that that's also a factor. There are some estimates, just to throw a little science out there, that suggest that the Arctic could be ice-free in 2013, which is pretty close. Some think it'll be as long as 2040. So I think there's a great deal of debate and work that still needs to be done to clarify that. And I'll let you look at those numbers. They're available in millions of different places. What's more important, I think, is that we need to know more about it. We need to understand it a little bit better. Canada, in order to do this, invested lots of money. We were the single largest donor for the International Polar Year. Which resulted in a lot of activity and focus on Arctic science and attempts to get a better grip on what we need to know in order to work well in the Arctic. That continues to be an important part of the Northern Strategy. We've emphasized science, as I indicated in an earlier slide, and one of the initiatives specifically related to that is the creation of a High Arctic Research Center. The government announced, I guess, last year that it would be in Cambridge Bay. And the idea there is not only will it support Canadian science, but that it would become a world center where scientists can work together and can share their findings, can share their experiments, and that way we can build a shared understanding of what we need to know about management of the Arctic region. There's also a great deal of collaboration with the U.S. directly. One, I think, project that many of you may be aware of is the work of the Louis Saint-Laurent and the Healy, which are two Coast Guard cutters that have been working to map the ocean floor for a number of years now. It's an important collaboration because that science will underwrite submissions to the United Nations Law of the Sea when Canada submits its proposal that indicates our version of the full extent of our outer continental shelf. It's important because clearly we're neighbors. clearly there will be overlap in the submissions that are made by various Arctic nations, but if we're basing it on shared science, then surely that will make the next steps easier, and the next steps will be a bilateral process that will outline where boundaries need to lie. Science underpins policy, and we will need policy to deal with this. As we have thinning Arctic ice, as we have increased attention on the Arctic, we are absolutely sure that there will be increased traffic, movement of goods, movement of people. There are a number of people already who've decided that it would be nice to have a holiday in the Arctic, and I agree, that might be okay, but I'd rather not run into something. So this is just a little picture that shows where people think shipping might go. And I want to underline here, Canada does not believe, the Canadian Ice Service in particular, does not believe that the waterways collectively known as the Northwest Passage will ever really be navigable. They're not going to be the best place to move your boat around in. They're always going to have bits of ice in it. They're always going to have bits of ice. Dangerous ice. They're always going to have, we have bits of ice in our glasses here, but that's not what I'm talking about. It's not going to be the best place to take a great big boat or to have a whole lot of activity. There are plenty of other places in the Arctic that are more likely candidates for that. And having said that, we do expect that it will be a busy place in the future. Canada has already gotten out in front in an attempt to strengthen the regulatory framework, and we intend to work with international partners to take that further. But one thing we have implemented, and the United States has as well, is the extension of a 200-mile limit on the Arctic waterways, and that allows us to impose pollution and other sorts of regulatory measures, one of them being Nordreg, which is a requirement to report as vessels enter Canadian waters, vessels above a certain size, so that emissions and other sorts of polluting factors can be monitored. We're also working with the International Maritime Organization to develop an international polar regime, which I think will be of tremendous value. Oil and gas. There probably is a lot of it up there. And again, Arctic science is important, and we need to take steps to be sure that the regulatory frameworks are in place, because this has to be consistent with our commitment to the environment. If we're going to pursue a well-developed north, if we're going to pursue a thriving one where the lives of people matter, we have to be sure that we have a regulatory framework that supports that. And Canada is confident that these things can coexist. There isn't any offshore drilling going on in the Canadian Arctic at the moment, but our National Energy Board has been mandated to set up a regulatory regime that would be responsive to potential threats and potential challenges to drilling in the Arctic. And Fran Elmer gave me a surprise gift, which is the results of this regime and this commission. This is the Deepwater Horizon and the Presidential Commission examining the impacts of that. And Canada will draw on this and other reports and work to develop a set of regulations. And we'll work with partners as well to ensure that it's consistent, that will protect our ability to develop the resources in the Arctic in an environmentally sustainable way, and to be sure that we have the mechanisms in place to react swiftly if we need to. Fish. One of my favorite prime ministerial quotes is a guy called Pierre Trudeau, who was Prime Minister of Canada for quite some time, and one of those eminently quotable guys. And in an international discussion about fisheries and the management of fisheries, he said, well, the thing is, fish swim. So you really can't much yet. Having said that, we can control where the fish are swimming into, who controls the water that they swim in and out of. But at the moment, most of the fish stocks are well within areas of control designated by the governments who control the Arctic waterways. It's Canada's view that there's enough regulation in place already, that the regime that's in place under the UN Fish Stocks Agreement is adequate to manage any sort of a fisheries that might eventually develop in the Arctic. There's not much right now, but obviously it's something that's on the horizon, and the United States is obviously seized of this, having put in place a U.S. moratorium for the moment until further research can be conducted. And that's another place where we're in agreement. We feel that we need more information about Arctic fish stocks, how they might best be managed, but for the time being, Canada remains of the opinion that there's sufficient international framework to manage a potential Arctic fisheries. Public safety. increasingly this will be an issue in the Arctic. At the moment, there's very little in place to respond to people in need or in distress in the Arctic, and we need to work together to ensure that that situation changes. There's considerable work underway in the Arctic Council, and they've met with some success. We have a draft agreement that's currently in consideration, and we'll move through the process to finalize that agreement among the partners at the Arctic Council. But Canada believes that attention in this area cannot be underdone. We feel we need to focus very strongly on developing a solid set of policies and of agreements that will ensure that the people in the Arctic are safe and that we're able to act in a situation of emergency. Again, I mean, one element of this program would be sort of the bottom bullet there. What kind of boats are people taking into the Arctic? And is there some sort of set of regulations or some sort of process at place that ensures that they're prepared for the conditions that they will meet? And we feel that this is an important thing. This is also something that we can work very closely with the state of Alaska on. Resources on the ground, John Madden is here, and we work closely with Mr. Madden at the DHS in terms of trying to identify opportunities and ways that international communities can work together to support the safety of Alaskans and the coastal waterways here. And having a handle on all of these factors is important for one reason. And I mentioned this earlier on. The North is about the lives of the people in the North. And when we have a grip on public safety, when we understand the environment, when our science is in place, and when we pay due respect to Northerners, I think we will end up with a situation where we can have healthy and vibrant communities in the North. And the Government of Canada is committed to putting things in place that will help that situation to develop. One of the things is in creating an economic development agency devoted to development in the North. We have Atlantic Economic Development Opportunities Agency, and we'll create an Arctic one as well that would match that. There's also one in the West, and the idea behind those agencies is to focus on regional particularities and opportunities and seek to develop the conditions that will best promote investment and trade and economic activity in those regions. And we've got one in place now for the Arctic. It's called CanNor. It's a comprehensive government agency that involves social development as well as investment in economic activity and trade law. It's in its early stages. It's based in the North, in Iqaluit. But the important thing as well is that CanNor has a deputy minister that's based in Ottawa. And what that means is that they will have direct access to cabinet and to senior level processes within the federal government that will ensure that attention and that funds and the policies can flow through CanNor in a way that will have a timely and meaningful impact on the North. So basically, we believe that the Arctic already is a stable and rules-based region. There's a history of cooperation for the most part. It's not been one of conflict, and we don't foresee a future that would be any different. We think the most important tool to achieve this is the Arctic Council. This is going to promote greater policy dialogue and cooperation and coordination. We think it's important that be expanded. We also think the outreach of the Arctic Council is something that needs a little more attention. It's been in place for some time now, but I don't think that many people understand what the Arctic Council is all about and how it operates, and that's a conversation for another day, but the institution itself is something that we're committed to, and it needs a better outreach policy. The Arctic Council needs actively to support research and make sure that it focuses on the emerging issues of the Arctic so that policy decisions are based on fact. But the Arctic Council is a multilateral institution. And for that, and for it to be successful, we need to think hard about how it functions, what sort of support it needs, who are the members, how do they interact, what do we do about countries that are not Arctic but have very valuable input for what goes on in the North, and how do we include them? And those are discussions that are underway at the moment in the context of the Arctic Council. Canada is very supportive of that process, but we would like to see a hasty outcome to a sense of who makes decisions in the Arctic and how those decisions are arrived at. For the moment, we have important agreements in place already. There was a declaration signed at Ilulissat between the key Arctic nations. And we believe that the principles contained in that declaration are good basis to go forward in the Arctic. We believe that the legal framework that exists is sufficient, and we believe that the means of engaging internationally is also. But this picture here is here for a reason. This is our Arctic delegation to the Arctic Council. That's our senior Arctic official, she's now the ambassador to South Africa, but that's another story. Anyway, it would be Sheila Reardon, that's the minister, and then we have the representatives of the permanent participants in the Arctic Council for Canada. We are represented by Northerners at the Arctic Council, together with the Department of Foreign Affairs. Canada's vision for the Arctic, then, is that it should be a stable and rules-based region with clearly defined boundaries, dynamic economic growth and trade, vibrant northern communities, and healthy and productive ecosystems. Not so bad. We think we're pretty close, but we think we have to stay on top of this. We need to gain more science and interaction to make it happen. And clearly defined boundaries? Canada's involved currently in two disputes. One of them, here, right at the Beaufort Sea. The other one is Hounce Island, which is a piece of territory about the size of this room, but critically important. And again, Canada and Denmark are engaged on resolving that issue and are closing in, we hope, on a solution to that. This is the statement that underlies our foreign policy, our Arctic foreign policy. It was announced in August of last year. And since that time, we've been committed to finding ways to get this out into the international community and have it well understood. This is what Canada wants in the Arctic, nothing more and nothing less. And just a few bullets on how we think we might, some of the things that we're doing to help to achieve that. Resolution of boundary disputes. We're working on a regular basis with the United States and with Denmark to confirm and to clarify those particular disputes. But in addition to that, recognition of OCS, which stands for Outer Continental Shelf. So working with partners on the ocean floor mapping effort and making sure that we have the science that we need to make a solid submission to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. We will continue to pursue Arctic governance. I mentioned a few of the initiatives, public safety, the Polar Code, and the IMO. And we also believe that it's important to seek the international conditions for a good economic development environment. And we're going to do that by ensuring it's a good environment for investment, that we have the right trade agreements in place, and that things like shipping routes that would contribute to that are also considered. I'm not going to go through all of these bullet points, but essentially the things that I had mentioned before are integrated into our international strategy, and we're working with partners, with key Arctic partners, to ensure that they remain high on the agenda, and at the end of the day, engaging Northerners, and particularly the youth in the Arctic, in the achievement of the Arctic foreign policy. And just these last few points, these are the things that we think are priorities that we need to keep our eye well on. And the last thing I want to mention is the last bullet there, establishment of Canadian International Center for the Arctic Region. Department of Foreign Affairs has shipped out its policy shop to Norway, to Oslo, Norway. And we're running most of the work that we do on Arctic foreign policy from there for a couple of reasons. One is because we're close to the partners in Europe with whom we will engage on a regular basis. And the other is because if you always think about foreign policy priorities from Ottawa, you sometimes lose sight of what that means on the ground and what that means in an actual Arctic and northern environment. I'm pleased to say that one element of that Arctic center is here in Anchorage. And I'll just take a minute now to introduce Nancy Hemseth, who joined the consulate in December. She's our Arctic advocacy officer and focal point for the Canadian International Center for the Arctic Region. So she ensures that Canadian Arctic foreign policy is well informed by our relations on the ground here in Alaska. There's also, interestingly, an Arctic advocacy officer in Washington. So embedded within our approach to take this policy forward is an understanding that Alaska is different than Washington, and that we need to have an equal representation from the U.S. Arctic in our national attempts to work with the U.S. on Arctic foreign policy. The other person I'd like to introduce is Allison Biestock, who's also joined the consulate. She's our general relations officer, and Allison gets to do a range of other fun things that come across our desk every day. And then the last thing I want to mention is that this is an issue for us that's one of our top priorities in Anchorage, obviously, is working on the Arctic issue. And we'll be working with the Institute of the North in hosting an event February 24th and 25th that will focus on Arctic marine transportation. We'll be bringing a number of Canadian experts to Anchorage, and their U.S. counterparts will be here on the ground. And we'll have a day-long session on the 25th of February, a series of panels focusing on legal aspects, a little bit more deeply into some of the issues I touched on ever so briefly here, and this is part of our effort to engage with partners and understand each other better and perhaps think about some ways that we can move forward through these issues that are so important for Canada and the U.S. It's important that we work together because Canada will be the next chair of the Arctic Council starting in 2013. After that, it'll be the U.S. So I think if we work together now, we get ahead of the curve, we have a firm understanding of what North America wants to see in the Arctic, that'll help us to set up a good dialogue over the course of the next 5 years to engage appropriately and effectively and with the interests of Northerners squarely in our sights as we work to address the issues and the concerns of the Arctic. That doesn't mean that we're at sea on this issue. it means that we're out there trying. So thanks very much. That's my formal comments, and I would welcome some questions. We have lots of time, so.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Jennifer Lowton, Consul of Canada in Anchorage. Her talk on Canada's Arctic foreign policy was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council on January 28th. Following her presentation, Lowton responded to questions from audience members.
You focused mainly on the relationship with the U.S., which is understandable given where we are. But Russia has a very long Arctic coastline. Could you say a few words about how Russia fits into all of this?
Russia is a very engaged member of the Arctic Council. As far as Canada is concerned, that's the venue for these discussions, and the key partners are always at the table. We work regularly with Russia. We have a number of agreements in place with them for Arctic science. They are part of the range of international activities that goes on there. They were part of the working group as well that constructed the draft agreement on search and rescue in the Arctic. They're definitely, as is the United States and other Arctic partners, key in what will go on in the Arctic going forward. I guess just to save the poor lady with the mic, I'll stay in the back and then we can come up here after.
I'm Heather Hudson from ICER, and that was a great overview. I wonder if you can say anything about the potential conflicts that are bound to emerge among those goals. I mean, it's fine to say people first, and I think no one really would disagree at a social development level, and yet we know from not only Alaska but across the North that economic development often raises challenges that conflict perhaps with some social goals or not, and with some environmental goals. So is there a process, can you say anything about the process within Canada of how those goals are supposed to be implemented in a way that they are collaborative rather than at the expense of one or the other of them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Heather. And if I had the answer to that, no. But seriously, I think the real answer to that question is that I think everyone recognizes that the challenges are real and ongoing. That's why we didn't make the specific issues the headers in the Northern Strategy Agenda. We made governance the focus. It's one of the four pillars. So it's recognition that the way we come to decisions and how we manage the interactions between people, between stakeholder groups, between our priorities is as important as what those priorities are. There's a long tradition. The government of Canada, I can't even begin to tell you, they wedded to consultation to an annoying degree. And that can be good. It means that we bring people to the table in a lot of creative ways. We also are absolutely wedded to the idea of the permanent participants in the Arctic Council as a unique structure. This is the only multilateral body that has governments sitting side by side in an equal status with non-governmental stakeholder groups that are specifically identified. And I think that's something that we continue to be to recognize as important. And that, I think, helps us to ensure that people's perspectives come forward, that when you're looking at some conflicting priorities, you can look at what some of the underlying arguments are there and see if there are other ways that those interests and those issues can be addressed and met. But again, the thing I think I really want to underline is process is important, and the Northern Strategy Agenda recognizes that in making governance part of its outcomes and its initial starting point, too. Okay, we'll do one more there, and then we'll come up here.
I wonder if you could comment on the Canadian perspective on the clash between polar bear preservation and the development of oil and gas.
Canada thinks we have enough in place to protect the polar bears. We're happy with the current set of regulations. We're happy with the current protection that the Government of Canada has in place, and we think that these things can coexist. As far as the decisions that the United States will eventually come to, we're happy to observe that process. There's a question up here.
Villages like Sachs Harbour, Goya Heaven, and Frobisher Bay There are a lot of people there in Goya Heaven. 100 years ago, there was nobody there. There are a lot of people now there. There are no natural resources to give the people a means to have a decent living. It's obvious that a lot of their standard of living comes from government handout. How do you see that's developing in the future? There are no resources there for these people to live on the land. And three quarters, as you mentioned in your presentation, live from hunting and fishing. That is not sustainable. With that population density, what is going to happen, in your view, in the future?
That's another good question. And I think in particular situations or specific situations, I wouldn't want to speculate on a specific solution. But again, it goes back to governance. It's a question of looking at institutions like CanNor that have been created with the mandate of northern development in mind. And northern development that isn't just about finding ways to develop natural resources, but finding ways to attract other kinds of investments. Looking at the lives of northerners, and Frobisher Bay is a good example. What are ways that we can make that community thrive, and what are the challenges that that community faces? And if we have an institution that's specifically mandated to look at, to consider, and to work with governments in the north, I think we stand a much better chance, rather than looking again at, okay, how do we make this relate to resource development? Well, it's not just about that. It's about the collectivity of issues that lead to a thriving community. And I think you have to take a structured approach to that sort of thing. The north, it's expanding very rapidly. And I think we really need to pay careful attention and be well on top, together with the governments of the provinces and territories, on the development priorities of the region. And CanNor gives us a national presence in that debate in an effective way. It's a very well-resourced ministry. It's just getting its legs underneath it. But I'm hoping that they can play an effective role in dealing with some of the challenges that you've listed.
You mentioned the large percentage of the adults that didn't have formal education, and the large portion of the population of young people coming up. So my question is, since the lifestyle of those adults will change from the lifestyle of this new growing population of young people, are there anything put in place to either train, increase formal education that may be applicable for the young people as they come up to go into the marketplace?
Yeah, and again, having said what I said, I don't want to place undue value on, everyone knows how important a high school education is. It's absolutely critical, but those people, the population in the north that doesn't have an education, and our adults and seniors and elders, possess important knowledge. And the challenge is, how do you make sure that you provide the large young population with the education, with the skills, with the training that they need, without losing that traditional knowledge, and ensuring that their education is complete from a northern perspective, that they have what they need to survive in a modern world, but that they're also fully part of the tradition and the culture that they are part of. And as I understand it, Nunavut is stepping way out in front in this regard. There's the premier of Nunavut is extremely active on issues of education and training, most particularly. So it's getting a good solid education, but also the right sort of training and skills that one would need for a variety of opportunities. But there's also a commissioner for the province of Nunavut, whose specific mandate is to ensure that communities and villages have a means of bringing their concerns to the attention of the government. That's at a sort of territorial level. The Fed's role in that is somewhat different. Education is the purview and the domain of the provinces in Canada. That's the way that one runs. We can provide a certain amount of funding and support to ensure that it's also integrated with things that, for example, Industry Canada does, so training for skills development, for more technical things. But the province is going to be making that call and that decision. And by the look of it, the government of the state of Nunavut, the territory of Nunavut, is prepared to deal with that issue through a number of specific channels. But again, I think it's important that we not underestimate the value of the traditional knowledge that's sort of held in the elders in the population.
My 9-year-old school project is working on saving the polar bear and global warming. And, of course, she's very concerned about the Arctic. And how is Canada addressing the issue of global warming?
Well, there's an awful lot going on climate change. I sort of pointed to some of the work that's underway to support Arctic science to better understand it. And environment. So Environment Canada is at the head of that. There's also a number of things underway in the context of Natural Resources Canada that's looking at wildlife and the impact on the changing ecosystems on Arctic wildlife. It's one of the four pillars, environment. And when we say environment, we mean ecosystem management. So taking a broad perspective on the things that feed into and affect the changing environment. And I like to point out here that the environment is always changing. This is not a new phenomenon. We live in a world that's in a constant process of change, and we need to be prepared to deal with that. I think the other thing that I would want to mention in that regard is that Canada is also working internationally to ensure that, I mean, I don't think one country would possess a solution. I think what we need to do is have a global framework that takes account of the world that we're living in and of climate change and its effect on the way we live our lives, and that we make international decisions that are mutually reinforcing. So the agreements that we come to are underwritten, I suppose, by international support across the board. So whatever Canada did, we would require the support of our Arctic partners to ensure that it was effectively implemented and that it had any real impact down the road.
How many icebreakers and or research vessels does Canada have to gather the information you need?
There's a difference between an icebreaker and an ice-worthy vessel. Worthy isn't the right word. Nancy probably knows the right word. Capable. Capable. An ice-capable vessel. As I understand it, Canada has 5, as I understand it, ice-capable vessels. She's nodding, so I think that's right. I don't have the inventory, but we have 5, and I think building another one is part of the money that was devoted to the development of the Northern Strategy Agenda. I think they're looking at calling it the Diefenbaker, and it would be a cutting edge, so to speak, Arctic ice breaking and capable vessel. It's amazing how long these projects take, but I think we're looking at 2 years out to get it ready. She's not nodding anymore, so maybe we don't know. Anyway, where are they? Our Coast Guard is based in Sarnia. I laugh as I say that, and I know why that's the case. It's because a lot of what they do deals with the Great Lakes. So we don't have an icebreaker in Sarnia, but we do have, I think, on the northern Arctic, I think they base them out of... And on the western coast, I think it's, I want to say Iqaluit, and I know that it's not Iqaluit, but I'm sure. If you really want to know that, you can send me an email, and I'll be happy to put you in touch with people who really know. But as I understand it, they're sort of on either side. And at the moment, the Louis Saint-Laurent is actually at sea in the Arctic, completing, is that right? No, it's not. It's getting ready to begin its next season of science.
Around with all the Arctic Council members.
Who has the most? I don't want to say because I don't want to get it wrong, and I think I probably would. Nancy knows. Russia has a lot. Actually, do you want to, do you have anything more you want to add to that, Nancy? Because, okay. I forgot my icebreaker notes today, sorry.
Russia currently has the most icebreaking vessels available. They use them in the Northern Sea Route to escort through the Northern Sea Route.
Okay, but if you wanted to know anything more about that, I'd be happy to make sure you got the information you needed. It's, but the Helios has been a solid partner. They've held up their side of that agreement, and that's been extremely important. Doing that work jointly makes a lot of difference, and the United States has been fully and thoroughly engaged throughout, and I would never want to underestimate the importance of that. So, you know, maybe you don't have a dozen icebreakers, but you've got what's needed for that project to happen, for that partnership to be realized, and that's been very valuable to the ongoing international Arctic debate.
The United States and Canada has a vast border in common. Would you care to comment what security challenges that might be and what steps your government is taking?
I wouldn't say it's a security challenge, really. I mean, I don't want to get all diplomatic here on you or anything, but I mean, the border is an important important part of the Canada-U.S. relationship, and a lot of that changed after 9/11. We used to call it, and I kid you not, the swinging garden gate between two good neighbors, and that changed overnight when we all began to realize that the world was a different place and that we needed to take action to ensure that we were very clear on who was inside the country, what was going on, the goods that they had with them, and how they were moving them back and forth. Since then, the United States and Canada have worked very closely together on a number of really well thought out and clearly defined border management relationships. One is a smart border accord, and it sort of defines how people and goods move across the border and how the kinds of controls and measures and checks that need to be put into place to do that well. The Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative was another one, and that's the famous Passport Initiative. That was an initiative that the United States government put on the table that insisted that there be a passport to control the movement of people across the border. It's in full implementation at this point, so anytime you go to an airport or cross at a land border, a passport is required. I'd point out that a passport is required to get back into the U.S., not to get into Canada. Canada has not yet required that citizens of the Western Hemisphere need a passport to cross the border. You do need to be able to prove who you are and prove your nationality. If you're not a citizen of Canada and the U.S., you may be asked to produce a passport. And I would point out, too, that you may be asked to produce a passport anyway. Those kinds of documents are requested at the discretion of the border guard at the time, and that's true whether you're an American or a Canadian, and whether you're crossing into Canada or into the United States. The other thing I would say is that there's an impressive, impressive level of cooperation at the operational level. I always worked on these things from a policy perspective, and that's a different kettle of fish. When you're actually at the border crossings and when you're dealing with either CBSA, which is Canadian Border Services, or CBP, Customs and Border Protection on the United States side, those guys know what they're doing. They know, they're very close, they know the families of their colleagues across the border. They see each other on a regular basis, and they run the border extremely well and extremely professionally. The level of cooperation makes that work efficiently as well as securely. We now talk about the longest secure border in the world, which is exactly what we enjoy. The important part of border management is making sure that the really, really integrated economies upon which both of our countries depend aren't interrupted by the management of border traffic. I think we've come to a fairly good place. We came there pretty quickly, actually, too. The process of implementing the WHTI was an interesting one, but we managed to get through that, too. And I think now we're at a point where there's a recognition, particularly after the events of the last few years, of the importance of value chains, of the integrated economy and the border, and the effect that managing the border can play on ensuring that we have the kinds of relationships we need to run the North American economy. So, yeah, it's always going to be there. It's our border, and it defines who we are and who we aren't on either side of that. But at the same time, I think we all need to recognize that we're also a region and that we've always been friends, allies, neighbors. We play bridge across the border. My mother-in-law lives in St. Stephens, which is right across from Calais, Maine, which I cannot stop from wanting to say Calais, but anyway. So this is part of her life all the time. She's constantly back and forth, and now she's got a passport in her glove compartment, which normally, I mean, it's right next to the car insurance, I think, that you normally keep in there, and now it's a passport. So things change, we adapt, our relationships remain in place, and I think it's that last bit that's most important. The relationship remains as strong as it ever was, and we find new ways to deal with new challenges that pop up from time to time as they do.
Hi, I'm going to go ahead and ask a question about the polar bears. My question is, do you know if they're increasing or decreasing in Canada? And if we reduce the carbon output, is that going to have an initial effect, or is that going to take, you know, hundreds of years to actually have an effect? Or is this a natural cyclical thing that we're just going through right now?
Yeah, the last part of the question is something for another kind of expert. The impact of the carbon on the polar bears isn't something that I can personally comment on. I can tell you that the Government of Canada is convinced that the polar bear population is healthy and that the regulations in place are sufficient to manage it well. Beyond that, you'd have to, as far as the impact of carbon, I really don't want to go down that road. It's not my area of expertise, and I would not want to pretend that it was. So, a very disappointing answer for the last one, but anyway, thank you very much. Oh, there's one hand up.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans. This week's program with Jennifer Lowton, Consul of Canada in Anchorage, was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council. Jennifer Lowton responded to questions from audience members following her talk on Canada's Arctic foreign policy, recorded on January 28, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.